Chapter 4. Behold these joyful devourers, the land laid out skewered in silver, candlesticks of softest pewter, rolling the logs down cut on end to make roads through the forest that once was. Before the logs were rolled down cut on end, we called it Stump Road, and we called it Forest Road when our imaginations starved. You can make fans with ribs of sheep and pouches for baubles by pounding flat the ears of old women and old men. Older is best, for the ear grows forever, it said, even when there's not a scrap anywhere to eat. So we carried our wealth in pendulum pouches, wrinkled and hairy, diamonds and gems enough to buy a forest or a road, but maybe not both. Enough even for slippers of supplest skin, feathered in down like a baby's cheek. There is a secret we know when nothing else is left and the sky stops its tears. A belly can bulge full on diamonds and gems, and a forest can make a road through what once was. You just won't find any shade. Pendulums were once toys. Badal of Corbant's snake. To journey into the other worlds, a shaman or witch of the Elan would ride the spotted horse. 7 herbs, softened with beeswax and rolled into a ball, and then flattened into an oblong disc that was taken into the mouth and held between lip and gum. Coolness slowly numbing and saliva rising as if the throat was the mouth of a spring. A tingling sensation lifting to gather behind the eyes in coalescing colours. And then, in a blinding flash, the veil between worlds vanished. Patterns swirled in the air, complex geometries played across the landscape, a landscape that could be the limitless wall of a hide tent or the rolling plains of a cave wall where ran the beasts, until the heart stains emerged, pulsing, blotting the scene in undulating rows, sweet as waves and tasting of mother's milk. So arrived the spotted horse, a cascade of heart stains rippling across the beast, down its long neck, sweeping along its withers, flowing like seed heads from its mane and tail. Ride into the alien world. Ride among the ancestors and the not yet born, among the tall men with their eternally swollen members, the women with their forever filled wombs, through forests of black threads, the touch or brush of any one of them an invitation to endless torment, for this was the path of return for all life, and to be born was to pass through and find the soul's fated thread, a tale of a future death that could not be escaped. To ride the other way, however, demanded a supple traverse, evading such threads, lest one's own birth fate become entangled, knotted, and so doom the soul to eternal prison, snared within the web of conflicted fates. Prophecies could be found among the black threads, but the world beyond that forest was the greatest gift. Timeless, home to all the souls that ever existed, this was where grief was shed, where sorrow dried up and blew away like dust, where scars vanished. To journey into this realm was to be cleansed, made whole, purged of all regrets and dark desires. Riding the spotted horse and then returning was to be reborn, guiltless, guileless. Calith knew all this, but only second-hand. The riders among her people passed on the truths generation upon generation. Any one of the 7 herbs, if taken alone, would kill. The 7 mixed in wrong proportions delivered madness. And finally, only those chosen as worthy by the shamans and witches would ever know the gift of the journey. For one such as Calith, mired in the necessary mediocrity so vital to the maintenance of family, village, and the Elan way of living, to take upon herself such a ritual, to even so much as taste the 7 herbs, was a sentence to death and damnation. Of course, the Elan were gone. No more shamans or witches to be found. No families, no villages, no clans, no herds. Every ring of teepee stones spanning the rises tucked at the foot of yet higher hilltops now marked the motionless remnant of a final camp, a camp never to be returned to, the stones destined to sink slowly where they lay, the lichen on their undersides dying, the grasses so indifferently crushed beneath them turning white as bone. Such boulder rings were now maps of extinction and death. They held no promises, only the sorrow of endings. She had suffered her own damnation, one devoid of any crime, any real culpability beyond her cowardly flight, her appalling abandonment of her family. There had been no shamans left to utter the curse, but that hardly mattered, did it? She sat as the sun withered in the west and the grasses surrounding her grew wiry and grey, staring down at the disk lying in the palm of her hand. Elan magic, as foreign to her world now as the Chemal machines in Ampelus Rooted had been when she'd first set eyes upon them. To ride the spotted horse through the ashes of her people invited what? She did not know, could not know. Would she find the spirits of her kin? Would they truly look upon her with love and forgiveness? Was this her secret desire? Not a quest into the realms of prophecy seeking hidden knowledge, not searching for a mortal sword and a shield anvil for the Kachain Chemal. Dire confusion. Her motivations were suspect. Ha! Rotted through and through. And might there not be another kind of salvation she was seeking here? The invitation into madness, into death itself? Possibly. Beware the leader who has nothing to lose. Her people were proud of their wise sayings, and yet now, in their mortal silence, wisdom and pride proved a perfect match in value, namely worthless. The Chemal were camped, if one could call it that, behind the rise at her back. They had built a fire inviting Kalith's comfort, but this night she was not interested in comfort. The Shigal assassin still circled high in the darkening sky above them, their nightly sentinel who never tired and never spoke and yet was known to all, she suspected, as their potential slayer, should they fail. Blessings of the spirits, that was a ghastly creature, a demon to beggar her worst nightmares. Oh, how it sailed the night winds, a cold-eyed raptor, a conjuration of singular purpose. Kalith shivered. Then, squeezing shut her eyes as the sun's sickle of fire dipped below the horizon, she slid the disk into her mouth. Stinging like a snake's bite, and then numbness, spreading, spreading. Never trust a leader who has nothing to lose. At these muttered words from the human female, drifting over the hummock down to where stood the Kachain Chemal, the Kel hunter Sag Churok swung round his massive, scarred head. Over his eyes, three distinct lids blinked in succession, reawakening the camp's reflected firelight in a wet gleam. The matron's daughter, Gunth Mak, seemed to flinch, but she remained closed to Sag Churok's tentative query. The other two Kel hunters, indifferent to anything the human might say, were half-crouched and facing away from the ring of stones that surrounded a half-dozen bricks of burning Bedouin dung, away from the flames that could steal their night vision. The enormous cutlasses at the ends of their wrists rested point down, their arms stretched out to the sides. By nature, Kel disliked such menial tasks as sentry duty. They existed to pursue quarry, after all. But the matron had elected to send them out without Jan sentinels, further proof that in keeping all her guardians close, Gunthan Asil feared for her own life. Senior among these Kel, Sag Churok was Gunth Mak's protector, and should the time come when the Destriant found a mortal sword and a shield anvil, then he would also assume the task of escorting them on the return to Asil Nest. Errors in judgment plagued Ampelus Rooted. A flawed matron produced flawed spawn. This was a known truth. It was not a thing that could be defeated or circumvented. The spawn must follow. Even so, Sag Churok knew an abiding sense of failure, a dull, persistent anguish.
Beware the leader.
Yes, the one they had chosen, known as Red Mask, had proved as flawed as any Kachain Chemal of the Hive, and the cruel logic of that still stung. Perhaps the matron was correct in electing a human to undertake the search this time. Visions bound with intent whispered through Sag Churok. The Shigal assassin, wheeling in the darkness far above them, had thrust a sending into the brain of the Kell hunter. Cold, rough-skinned, careless of the pain the sending delivered, indeed, it was of such power that Guntsmuck's head snapped up, eyes fixing on Sag Chorok as ripples overflowed to brush her senses.
Intruders in vast herd, countless fires. Perhaps then among these ones,
Sag Chorok sent in return.
The one who leads is not for us.
A bestial scent followed that statement, one that Sag Chorok recognized. Glands awakened beneath the heavy armored scales along the Kell's spine, the first of the instinctive preparations for hunting, for battle. And as those scales seemed to lift and float on the thickening layer of oil, the innermost lids closed over his eyes, rising from below to entirely sheathe his vision. Boulders on a distant hill suddenly glowed, still bearing the heat of the sun. Small creatures moved in the grasses, revealed by their breaths, their rapidly beating hearts. Kell Rhythok and Kor Thoran both caught the bitter signature of the oil, and they straightened from their crouches, swinging free their swords. A final thought reached Sag Chorok.
Too many to slay. Best avoid.
How do we avoid, Shigal Gurul? Do they bestride our chosen path?
But the assassin did not deem such questions worth an answer, and Sag Chorok felt the Shigal's contempt. Guntsmuck sent her guardian a private thought.
He wishes that we fail.
If he so hungers to slay, then why not these strangers?
It is not for me to say, she replied. Gorol spoke not to me, after all, but to you. He would admit to nothing, but he holds you in respect. You have hunted, and like me you have borne wounds and tasted your own blood, and in that taste we both saw our mortality. This Gorol shares with you, while Rhythok and Kor Thoran do not.
And yet in his careless power his thoughts leak to you.
Does he know of my growth? I think not. Only you know the truth, Sag Chorok. To all others I reveal nothing. They believe me still little more than a drone, a promise, a possibility. I am close, first love, so very close.
Yes, he had known, or thought he had. Now shock threatened to reveal itself, and the Kell struggled to contain it.
Gunthan Asil?
She cannot see past her suffering.
Sag Chorok was not certain of that, but he sent nothing. It was not for him to counsel Guntsmuck, after all. Also, the notion that the Shigal assassin sought to share anything with him was troubling. The taste of mortality was the birth of weakness, after all. Rhythok addressed him suddenly, gruffly pushing through his inner turmoil.
You waken to threat, yet we sense nothing. Even so, should we not quench this useless fire?
Yes, Rhythok. The Destrian sleeps, and we have no need.
Do you hunt?
No, but we are not alone in this land. Human herds move to the south.
Is this not what Asil desires? Is this not what the Destrian must find?
Not these ones, Rhythok. Yet we shall pass through this herd. You will, I think, taste your own blood soon. You and Kor Thoran, prepare yourselves.
And with faint dismay, Sag Chorok saw that they were pleased. The air thickened, clear as the humour of an eye, and all that Kalith could see through it shimmered and shifted, swam and blurred. The sweep of stars flowed in discordant motion, the grasses of the undulating hills wavered, as if startled by wayward winds. Motes of detritus drifted about, shapeless and faintly pulsing crimson, some descending to roll across the ground, others wandering skyward as if on rising currents. Every place held every memory of what it had once been. A plain that had been the bottom of a lake, the floor of a shallow sea, the lightless depths of a vast ocean. a hill that had been the peak of a young mountain, one of a chain of islands, the jagged fang of the earth buried in glacial ice. Dust that had been plants, sand that had been stone, stains that had been bone and flesh. Most memories, Calith understood, remain hidden, unseen and beneath the regard of flickering life. Yet once the eyes were awakened, every memory was then unveiled, a fragment here, a hint there, a host of truths whispering of eternity. Such knowledge could crush a soul with its immensity, or drown it beneath a deluge of unbearable futility. As soon as the distinction was made, that separation of self from all the rest, from the entire world beyond, its ceaseless measure of time, its whimsical game with change played out in slow siege and in sudden catastrophe, then the self became an orphan, bereft of all security, and face to face with a world now become at best a stranger, at worst an implacable, heartless foe.
In arrogance we orphan ourselves, and then rail at the awful solitude we find on the road to death.
But how could one step back into the world? How could one learn to swim such currents? In self-proclamation, the soul decided what it was that lay within in opposition to all that lay beyond. Inside, outside, familiar, strange, that which is possessed, that which is coveted, all that is within grasp, and all that is forever beyond reach. The distinction was a deep, vicious cut of a knife, severing tendons and muscles, arteries and nerves. A knife? No, that was the wrong weapon, a pathetic construct from her limited imagination. Indeed, the force that divided was something other. It was, she now believed, maybe even alive. The multi-layered vista before her was suddenly transformed. Grasses withered and blew away. High dunes of sand humped the horizon, and in a basin just ahead of her she saw a figure, its back to her as it knelt in the hard-edged shadow of a monolith of some sort. The stone, if that was what it was patinated with rust, the mottled stains looking raw, almost fresh against the green-black rock. She found herself drawing closer. The figure was not simply kneeling in worship or obeisance, she realized. It was digging, hands thrust deep into the sands, almost up to the elbows. He was an old man, his skin blue-black, bald, the skin covering the skull scarred. If he heard her approaching, he gave no sign. Was this some moment of the past, millennia unfolding as all those layers fleeted away? Was she now witness to a memory of the wastelands? The monolith, Calith suddenly comprehended, was carved in the likeness of a finger, and the stone that she had first seen as green and black was growing translucent, serpentine green, revealing inner flaws and facets. She saw seams like veins of deep emerald, and masses that might be bone, the color of true jade, deep within the edifice. The old man, whose skin was not blue and black as she had first believed, but so thickly tattooed in swirling fur that nothing of its natural tone remained, now spoke, though he did not cease thrusting his hands into the sand at the base of the monolith.
"There is a tribe in the Sanimon," he said, "that claims it was the first to master the forging of iron. They still make tools and weapons in the traditional manner, quenching blades in sand, just as I'm doing right now, do you see?"
Though she did not know his language, she understood him, and at his questions she squinted once more at his arms. If his hands gripped weapons, then he had pushed them deep into the sands indeed. Yet she saw no forge, not even a fire pit, anywhere in sight.
"I do not think," the man continued, gasping every now and then as if in pain, "I do not think, however, that I have it exactly right. There must be some other secrets involved, quenching in water or manure piles. I have no experience in such things." He paused. "At least, I don't think I do. So much forgotten."
"You are not Elan," Calith said.
He smiled at her words, although instead of looking at her, he fixed his gaze on the monolith.
"But here is a thing," he said. "I can name, 100 different tribes,
Seven cities tribes, Quantalian tribes, Corel tribes, Jenabakan, and they all share one thing and one thing only. And do you know what that is? He waited, as if he had addressed the monolith rather than Kallith, who stood beside him, close enough to reach out and touch.
I will tell you, he then said. Every one of them is or is about to be extinct, melted away in the fashion of all peoples eventually. Sometimes some semblance of their blood lives on, finds new homes, watered down, forgetful. Or they're nothing but dust, even their names gone, forever gone. No one to mourn the loss, and all that.
I am the last Elan, she told him.
He resumed pushing his hands deep into the sand, as deep as he could manage.
I am readying myself to wield a most formidable weapon. They thought to hide it from me. They failed. Weapons must be tempered, and tempered well, of course. They even thought to kill it, as if such a thing is remotely possible.
He paused.
Then again, perhaps it is. The key to everything, you see, is to cut clean down the middle. A clean cut. That's what I dream of.
I dream of this, she said. I have ridden the spotted horse. I have found you in the realms beyond. Why? Have you summoned me? What am I to you? What are you to me?
He laughed.
Now that amuses me. I see where you're pointing. You think I don't? You think I am blind to this, too?
I ride the...
Oh, enough of that. You took something. That's how you get here. That's how everyone gets here. Or they dance and dance until they fall into and out from their bodies. Whatever you took just eased you back into the rhythm that exists in all things, the pulse of the universe, if you like. With enough discipline, you don't need to take anything at all, which is a good thing, since after 10 or 20 years of eating herbs or whatever, most shamans are inured to their effects anyway. So the ingesting serves only as ritual, as permission to journey.
He suddenly halted all motions.
Spotted horse, yes. Visual hallucinations, patterns floating in front of the eyes. The Bivik called it wound drumming, like blossoming bloodstains, I suppose they meant. Thump, thump, thump. And the fen.
The matron looks to our kind, she cut in. The old ways have failed.
The old ways ever fail, the old man said. So too the new ways, more often than not.
She is desperate.
Desperation delivers poison counsel.
Have you nothing worthwhile to tell me?
The secret lies in the tempering, he said. That is a worthwhile thing to tell you. Your weapon must be well tempered, soundly forged, ingeniously annealed, the edges honed with surety. The finger points straight towards them, you see. Well, if this were a proper sky, you'd see.
His broad face split in a smile that was more a grimace than a signature of pleasure, and she thought that despite his words suggesting otherwise, he might be blind.
It is a flaw, he continued, to view mortals and gods as if they were on opposite sides. A flaw, an error most fundamental. Because then, when the blade comes down, why, they are forever lost to each other. Now, does she understand? Possibly. But if so, then she terrifies me, for such wisdom seems almost inhuman.
He shook himself and leaned back, withdrawing his arms from the sand. She stared, curious and wondering at the weapons he held, only to find he held none, and that his hands, the hue of rust, gleamed as if polished. He held them up.
Expected green, did you? Green jade, yes, and glowing. But not this time, not for this, oh no. Are they ready? Ready to grasp that most deadly weapon? I think not.
And down went those hands, plunging into the sands once more. A foot troop of human scouts, ranging well north of the main herd, had caught sight of the lone campfire. They now moved towards it, even as the distant flickering flames winked out, and spreading out into a crescent formation, they displayed great skill in stealth, moving virtually unseen across the plain. One of the scouts, white-painted face covered in dark cloth, came near a motionless hare, and the creature sensed nothing of the warrior edging past, no more than 5 paces away. Few plains were truly flat or featureless. Dips and rises flowed on all sides, stretches tilted, and in so doing mocked all sense of distance and perspective. Burrow mounds hid beneath tufts of grass. Gullies ran in narrow, treacherous channels that one could not see until one stumbled into them. To move unseen across this landscape was to travel as did the four-legged hunters and prey, from scant cover to scant cover, in fits and starts, eloquent as shadows. Even so, the wastelands were aptly named, for much of the natural plain had been scoured away, and spans of little more than broken rock and wind-blown sand challenged any measure of skill. Despite such restrictions, these scouts, 18 in number, betrayed not a breath as they closed in on where that campfire had been. Although all bore weapons, javelins and odd single-edged cutlasses, the former remained slung across their broad backs while the swords were strapped tight, bound and muffled at their sides. Clearly then, curiosity drove them to seek out the lone camp, to discover with whom they shared this land. 2,000 paces and closing, the scouts slipped into a broad basin, and all that lit them now was the pale jade glow of the mysterious travellers in the night sky. The crescent formation slowly inverted, the central scout moving ahead to form its apex. When the troop reached a certain distance, the lead scout would venture closer on his own. Gurul stood awaiting him. The towering Kachain Chemal should have been clearly visible, but not a single human saw him. When it was time to kill, the Shigal assassin could cloud the minds of his victims, although this was generally only effective while such targets were unsuspecting. And against other Shigal, Jan sentinels and senior Vegath soldiers, no such confusion was possible. These humans, of course, were feeble, and for all their stealth, the heat of their bodies made them blaze like beacons in Gurul's eyes. The lead scout padded directly towards the assassin, who waited, wings folded and retracted. The hinged claws on his narrow, long fingers slowly emerged from their membrane sheaths, slick with neural venom, although in the case of these soft-skinned humans, poison was not necessary. When the warrior came into range, Gurul saw the man hesitate, as if some instinct had awakened within him. But it was too late. The assassin lashed out one hand. Claws sliced into the man's head from one side, through flesh and bone, and the strength of the blow half tore the scout's head from his neck. Long before the first victim fell, Gurul was on the move, an arching scythe of night rushing to the next warrior. Claws plunged into the man's midsection, hooked beneath the ribcage, and the assassin lifted him from his feet and then flung the flailing, blood-spewing body away. Daggers flashed in the air as the rest of the scouts converged. Two of the thrown weapons struck Gurul, both skidding off his thick, sleek scales. Javelins were readied, poised for the throw, but the Shigal was already amongst them, batting aside panicked thrusts, claws raking through bodies, heads snapping out on its long neck, jaws crushing skulls, chests biting through shoulders. Blood spattered like sleet on the rough, stony ground, and burst in dark mists in the wake of the assassin's deadly blows. Two scouts pulled back, sought to flee, and for the moment Gurul let them go, occupied as he was with the last warriors surrounding him. He understood that they were not cowards, the two now running as fast as they could southward, each choosing his own path. No, they sought to bring word of the slaughter, the new foe, to the ruler of the herd. This was unacceptable, of course. Moments later, and the assassin stood alone, tail lashing, hands shedding long threads of blood. He drew a breath into his shallow lungs and then into his deep lungs, restoring strength and vigor to his muscles. He unfolded his wings. The last two needed to die. Gurul launched himself into the air, wings flapping, feather scales whistling a droning dirge. Once aloft, the bright forms of the two scouts shone like pyres on the dark plain, while in the assassin's wake as he swept towards the nearer of the two, 16 corpses slowly cooled, dimming like fading embers from a scattered hearth. Sag Chorok could smell blood in the air. He heard, as well, the frustrated snorts from the two unblooded hunters who stood, limbs quivering with the sweet flood of the nectar of slaying, that now coursed through their veins and arteries, their tails lashing the air. They had indeed lost control of their fight glands, a sign of their inexperience, their raw youth, and Sag Chorok was both amused and disgusted. Although, in truth, he himself struggled against unleashing the full flow of the nectar, forcing open his sleep glands to counteract the ferocious fires within. The Shigal had hunted this night, and in so doing he had mocked the Kel, stealing their glory, denying them the pleasure they sought, the pleasure they had been born to pursue. Come the dawn, Sag Chorok would lead the seeking well away from that scene of slaughter. Destriant Kallis need not know anything of it. The frame of her mind was weak enough as it was. The seeking would work eastward, further out into the wastes, where no food could be found for the strangers. Of course, this caution would likely fail if the herd was as vast as Gurul had intimated. And so Sag Chorok knew that his fellow hunters would find their blood before too long. They hissed and snorted, quivered and yawned with their jaws. The heavy blades thumped and grated over the ground. It did not occur to Gurul that the scores upon scores of dogs plaguing the human herd were anything but scavengers, such as the beasts that had once tracked the Kachain Chimal furies in times of war. And so the assassin paid no attention whatsoever to the 6 beasts that had moved parallel to the scouts, and had made no effort to cloud their senses. And even as these beasts now fled south, clearly making for the human herd, Gurul attributed no special significance to their peregrinations. Scavengers were commonplace, their needs singular and far from complex. The assassin killed the scouts, both times descending from above, tearing their heads from their shoulders, when they each halted upon hearing the moan of Gurul's wings. Task completed, the Shigal rose high into the dark sky, seeking the strong flows of air that he would ride through the course of the day to come. Air cold enough to keep him from overheating, for he had discovered that during the day his wings, when fully outstretched, absorbed vast amounts of heat, which in turn strained his equanimity and naturally calm repose. And that would not do. Kallith watched the scene before her fragment and then vanish as if blown away in a gust of wind she could not feel. The old man, the monolith, his polished hands and all his words, they had been a distraction, proof of her ignorance that she had so easily been snared by something and someone not meant for her. But it seemed that willpower alone was not enough, particularly when she had no real destination in mind. She had but mentally reached out for a notion, a vague feeling of the familiar. Was it any wonder she stumbled about, aimless, lost, pathetically vulnerable? Faintly, as if from the ether, she heard the old man say, "It ever appears dead, spiked so cruelly, and no, you will see no motion, not a twitch. Even the blood does not drip. Do not be deceived. She will be freed. She must. It is necessary." She thought he might have said something more, but his voice dwindled, and the landscape before her found a new shape. Wreckage or pyres burned across an unnaturally flat plain. Smoke rolled black and hot, stinging her eyes. She could make no sense of what she saw. The horizon seethed, as if armies contended on all sides, but nowhere close. Heavy shadows scudded over the littered ground, and she looked up. But beyond the columns of smoke rising from the pyres, the sky was empty, colourless. Something about those untethered shadows frightened Kallith, the way they seemed to be converging, gathering speed, and she could feel herself drawn after them, swept into their wake. It seemed then that she truly left her body behind, and now sailed on the same currents, casting her own paltry, shapeless shadow, and she saw that the wreckage looked familiar, not pyres as such, after all, but crushed and twisted pieces of the kinds of mechanism she had seen in Ampelus rooted. Her unease deepened. Was this a vision of the future, or some frayed remnant of the distant past? She suspected that the Kachane Chemal had fought vast wars centuries ago, yet she also knew that a new war was coming. The horizon drew closer, at a point where the massive shadows seemed destined to converge. Its seething edge was indeed armies locked in battle, yet she could make out little detail. Humans? Kachane Chemal? She could not tell, and even as she swept towards them, they grew indistinct, as if swallowed in dust. There would be nothing easy in any of this, Kallith realized. No gifts delivered with simple clarity, with unambiguous meaning. She floundered in sudden panic, trying to pull herself back as the shadows swarmed to a single point, only to vanish, as if plunging through a gate. She did not want to follow. She wanted none of this. Twin suns blazed to life, blinding her. Searing heat washed over her, building, and she screamed as she withered in the firestorm, but it was too late. She awoke, lying on the damp grasses, lids fluttering open, to find herself staring up at a paling sky. Dull motes still drifted across her vision, but she could feel their loss of strength. Kallith had returned, no wiser, no surer of the path ahead. Groaning, she rolled onto her side, and then to her hands and knees. Every bone in her body ached, twinges speared every muscle, and she shivered, chilled right down to the roots of her soul. Lifting her head, she saw that Sag Churok stood beside her, the hunter's terrible eyes fixed on her as if contemplating a hare trapped under his talons. She looked away and then climbed to her feet. The thin odor of dung smoke reached her, and she turned to see Gunth Mak hunkered down before the campfire, her huge hands deftly turning skewers of dripping meat. The damned creatures had been obsessed with meat from the moment they departed the nest. On this journey, she'd yet to see them unwrap a single root crop or lump of bread, or what passed for bread, for although on the tongue it possessed the consistency of a fresh mushroom, she had seen loaves in countless shapes and sizes. Meat to break the night's fast, meat at the mid-morning rest stop, meat whilst on the move at afternoon's waning, and meat at the final meal well after the sun's setting. She suspected that, if not for her, it would have been eaten raw. The wastelands offered little else, she had discovered, even the grasses, berries, and tubers that had once been common on the plains of the Elan were entirely absent here. Feeling miserable and terribly alone, she went over to collect her breakfast. Stavi looked to her sister and saw, as ever, her own face, although the expression was never a match to her own. Twins they might be, but they were also two sides of a coin, and took turns in what they offered to the world. Hetan knew as much, and had observed more than once how, when one of her first daughters set eyes upon the other, there grew a look of surprise and something like guilt in the child's face, as if in seeing an unexpected attitude displayed in her other self, she had perhaps ambushed her own innermost feelings. Not surprisingly, Stavi and Story were in the habit of avoiding one another's regard as much as was possible, as if neither welcomed that flash of confusion. They much preferred to sow confusion in everyone else, particularly, Hetan noted yet again, their adopted father. Although not within hearing range of the conversation, Hetan could well see how it was proceeding. The girls had stalked the poor man, wicked as a pair of hunting cats, and whatever it was that they wanted from him, they would get, without fail. Or so it would be, each and every time, if not for their cruel and clever mother, who, when she took it upon herself, could stride into the midst of the ambush and, with a bare word or gesture, send the two little witches scampering. Knowing this, of course, at least one of the twins would have her attention fixed on Hetan's location, measuring distances and the intensity of their mother's attention. Hetan knew that, should she so much as turn towards them, The girls would break off the wheedling, crassly manipulative assault on their father, and, flicking dark, sharp glares her way, scuttle off in the manner of frustrated evil imps the world over. Oh, they could be lovable enough when it suited them, and in sly gift from their true father, both possessed a natural talent for conveying innocence, so pure and so absolute it verged on the autistic, guaranteed to produce nausea in their mother, and other mothers besides. Why, Hetan had seen great aunts, normally indulgent as befitted their remote roles, narrow their gazes when witnessing the display. Of course, it was no easy thing to measure evil, or even to be certain that the assignation was appropriate. Was it not a woman's gift to excel in the entirely essential guidance of every aspect of her chosen man's life? It most certainly was. Accordingly, Hetan pitied the future husbands of Story and Stavi. At the same time, however, she was not about to see her own man savaged by the two creatures. The issue was down to simple possession, and the older the twins grew, the more brazen their efforts at stealing him away from her. Yes, she understood all of this. It was not anything direct or even conscious on the part of the girls. They were simply trying out their skills at capturing, rending, and devouring. And it was also natural that they would decide upon their own mother as competition. There were times, Hetan reflected, when she wished she could track down their distant, wayward, and diabolical father and thrust both rotters onto his plump lap. Yes, Crupper of Darujistan was indeed welcome to his inadvertent get. Alas, she could well see that the man who now stood in Crupper's stead would not have accepted such a gesture, no matter how just Hetan might deem it. Such were the myriad miseries of parenthood, and her bad luck in choosing an honourable mate. He was vulnerable, apt to descend into indulgence, and the twins knew it, and like piranhas, they had closed in. It wasn't that Stavi and Story were uniquely insensitive. Like all girls of their age, they just didn't care. They wanted whatever they wanted and would do whatever was necessary to get it. Long before their coming of age, of course, tribal life among the white-faced Bargast would beat that out of them, or at least repress its more vicious impulses, all of which were necessary to a proper life. Story was the first to note Hetan's approach, and the dark intent in her mother's eyes was reflected in a sudden flash of terror and malice in the girl's sweet, rounded face. She flicked her fingertips against her sister's shoulder, and Stavi flinched at the stinging snap, and then caught sight of Hetan. In a heartbeat, the twins were in full flight, bounding away like a pair of stoats, and their adopted father stared after them in surprise. Hetan arrived.
"Beloved, you have all the wit of a Bedouin when it comes to those two."
Onos Tulan blinked at her, and then he sighed.
"I am afraid I was frustrating them nonetheless. It is difficult to concentrate. They speak too fast, so breathless, I lose all sense of what they mean or want.
You can be certain that whatever it was, its function was to spoil them yet further. But I have broken their siege, Tul, to tell you that the clan chiefs are assembling. Well, those who manage to heed the summons." She hesitated. "They are troubled, husband."
Even this did little to penetrate the sorrow that he had folded round him since the brutal death of Tok the Younger.
"How many clans sent no one?" he asked.
"Almost a third."
He frowned at that, but said nothing.
"Mostly from the southern extremes," Hetan said. "That is why those here are now saying that they must have mutinied, lost their way, their will, that they have broken up and wandered into the kingdoms. The warriors hiring on as bodyguards and such to the Safin and the Balkando."
"You said mostly, Hetan. What of the others?"
"All outlying clans, those who travelled farthest in the dispersal, except for one. Gadra, which had found a decent Bedouin herd in a pocket between the Akrin and the Oldan, enough to sustain them for a time."
"The Gadra war chief, Stolman, yes? I sensed no disloyalty in him. Also, what chance of mutiny in that region? They would have nowhere to go. That makes no sense."
"You are right, it doesn't. We should have heard from them. You must speak to the clan chiefs, Tul. They need to be reminded why we are here."
She studied his soft brown eyes for a moment and then looked away. The crisis, she knew, dwelt not just in the minds of the Bargast clan chiefs, but also in the man standing beside her, her husband, her love.
"I do not know," said Tool slowly, as if searching for the right words, "if I can help them. The shoulder seers were bold in their first prophecies, igniting the fires that have brought us here. But with each passing day, it seems their tongues wither yet more. Their words dry up, and all I can see in them is the fear in their eyes."
She took him by the arm and tugged until he followed her out from the edge of the vast encampment. They walked beyond the pickets and then the ring-trenched dry latrines, and still further, on to the hard, uneven ground where the herds had tracked not so long ago, in the season of rains.
"We were meant to wage war against the Tist Edua," Tool said as they drew up atop a ridge and stared northward at distant dust clouds. "The shoulder seers rushed their rituals in finding pathways through the warrens. The entire white-faced Bargast impoverished itself to purchase transports and grain. We hurried after the grey swords."
He was silent for a moment longer, and then he said,
"We sought the wrong enemy."
"No glory to be found in crushing a crushed people," Petan observed, tasting the bitterness of her own words.
"Nor are people terrorized by one of their own."
There had been fierce clashes over this. Despite his ascension to war chief, a unanimous proclamation following the tragic death of her father, Onos Tulan had almost immediately found himself at odds with all the clan chiefs. War against the Lether Empire would be an unjust war, the Edur hegemony notwithstanding. Not only were the Lethari not their enemy, even these Tist Edur, crouching in the terrible shadow of their emperor, likely bore no relationship whatsoever to those ancient Edur who had preyed upon the Bargast so many generations past. The entire notion of vengeance, or that of a war resumed, suddenly tasted sour. And for Tool, an Imas who felt nothing of the old festering wounds in the psyche of the Bargast, who was indeed deaf to the fury of the awakened Bargast gods, well, he'd shown no patience with those so eager to shed blood. The shoulder seers had by this time lost all unity of vision. The prophecy, which had seemed so simple and clear, was all at once mired in ambiguity, seeding such discord among the seers that even their putative leader, Kafal, brother to Hetan, failed in his efforts to quell the schisms among the shamans. Thus, they had been no help in the battle of wills between Tool and the chiefs, and they were no help now. Kafal persisted in travelling from tribe to tribe. She had not seen her brother in months. If he had succeeded in repairing any damage, she'd not heard of it. Even among the shoulder seers in this camp, she sensed a pervasive unease and a sour reluctance to speak with anyone. Onos Tulan had been unwilling to unleash the white faces upon the Lether Empire, and his will had prevailed until that one fated day when the last of the All fell, when Tok the Younger had died. Not only had Hetan's own clan, the Sanan, been unleashed, so too had the dark hunger of Tul's own sister, Kilava. Hetan missed that woman and knew that her husband's grief was complicated by her departure, a departure that he might well see as her abandoning him in the moment of his greatest need. Hetan suspected, however, that in witnessing Tok's death and the effect it had had upon her brother, Kilava had been brutally reminded of the ephemeral nature of love and friendship, and so she had set out to rediscover her own life. A selfish impulse, perhaps, and an unfair wounding of a brother already reeling from loss. Yes, Kilava deserved a good hard slap to the side of that shapely head, and Hetan vowed that she would be the one to deliver it when next they met.
"I see no enemy," her husband said now.
She nodded. Yes, this was the crisis afflicting her people, and so they looked to their war chief, in need of a direction, a purpose. Yet he gave them nothing.
"We have too many young warriors," she said, "trained in the ancient ways of fighting, eager to see their swords drink blood. Slaughtering a half-broken, exhausted Lethari army did little to whet the appetites of those in our own clan.
yet it was enough to ignite envy and feuding with virtually everyone else.
Things were simpler among the Imas, said Tool.
Oh, rubbish! He shot her a glare, and then looked away once more, shoulders slumping.
Well, we had purpose.
You had a ridiculous war against a foe that had no real desire to fight you. And so instead of facing the injustice you were committing, you went and invoked the ritual of Telahan. Clever evasion, I suppose, if rather insane. What's so frightening about facing your own mistakes?
Dear wife, you should not ask that question.
Why not? He met her eyes again, not with anger this time, but bleak despair.
You may find that mistakes are all you have.
She grew very still, chilled despite the burgeoning heat of the morning.
Oh, and for you? Does that include me?
No, I speak to help you understand an Imas who was once a Tlan.
He hesitated and then said,
With you, with our children, I had grown to believe that such things were at last behind me. Those dread errors and the burden of all they yielded. And then, in an instant, I am reminded of my own stupidity. It does no good to ignore one's own flaws, Hetan. The delusion comforts, but it can prove fatal.
You're not dead.
Am I not?
She snorted and turned away.
You're just as bad as your sister.
Then wheeled back to him.
Wake up! Your 27 clans are down to 19. How many more will you lose because you can't be bothered to make a decision?
His eyes narrowed on her.
What would you have me decide? He asked quietly.
We are Whiteface Barghast. Find us an enemy.
The privilege of being so close to home was proving too painful, even as Torrent, the last warrior of the All, sought to exult in the anguish. Punishment for surviving, for persisting, like one last drop of blood refusing to soak into the red mud. He did not know what held him upright, breathing, heart pounding on and on, thoughts clawing through endless curtains of dust. Somewhere, deep inside, he prayed he would find his single, pure truth, squeezed down into a knucklebone, polished by all the senseless winds, the pointless rains, the spiraling collapse of season upon season. A little knot of something like bone to stumble over, to roll across, to send him sprawling. He might find it, but he suspected not. He did not possess the wit. He was not sharp in the way of Tok Anasta, the Mesler who haunted his dreams. Thundering hoofs, a storm-racked night sky, winds howling like wolves, and the dead warrior's single eye fixed like an opal in its shadowed socket. A face horrifying in its red, glistening ruin, the skin cut away, smeared teeth exposed in a feral grin. Oh, perhaps indeed the Mesler rode into Torrent's dreams, a harbinger of nightmares, a mocker of his precious, fragile truth. One thing seemed clear. The dead archer was hunting Torrent, fired by hatred for the last All warrior, and the pursuit was relentless, Torrent's steps dragging even as he ran for his life, gasping, shrieking, until with a start he would awaken, sheathed in sweat and shivering. It seemed that Tok Anasta was in no hurry to bring the hunt to its grisly conclusion. The ghost's pleasure was in the chase, night after night after night. The All warrior no longer wore a copper mask. The irritating rash that had mottled his face was now gone. He had elected to deliver himself and the children into the care of the Gadra clan, camped as they were at the very edge of the Aldan. He had not wished to witness the devastating grief of the strange warrior named Tool over Tok Anister's death. Shortly after joining the clan, and with the fading of his rash, Gadra women had taken an interest in him, and they were not coy, displaying a boldness that almost frightened Torrent. He had fled a woman's advance more than once, but of late the dozen or so intent on stalking and trapping him had begun cooperating with one another. And so he took to his horse, riding hard out from the camp, spending the entire span of the sun's arc well away from their predations, red-eyed with exhaustion, miserable in his solitude and at war with himself. He had never lain with a woman, after all. He had no idea what it involved, beyond those shocking childhood memories of seeing, through the open doorways of huts, adults clamped round one another, grunting and moaning and sighing. But they had been all, not these savage, terrifying Bargast, who coupled with shouts and barks of laughter, the men bellowing like bears and the women clawing and scratching and biting. No, none of it made any sense. For even as he endeavoured to escape these mad women with their painted faces and bright eyes, he wanted what they offered. He fled his own desire, and each time he did so, the torture he inflicted upon himself stung all the worse. Such misery as no man deserves. He should have rejoiced in his freedom, here on the vast plains so close to the Aldan, to see the herds of Bedouin, which his own people had never thought to tame, and the scattering of Rodara, too, that the surviving children of the All now cared for, and to know that the cursed Lethary were not hunting them, not slaughtering them. He should be exulting in the moment. Was he not alive, safe? And was he not the clan leader of the All, undisputed ruler of a vast tribe of a few score children, some of whom had already forgotten their own language and now spoke the barbaric foreign tongue of the Bargast, and had taken to painting their bodies with red and yellow ochre and braiding their hair? He rode his horse at a slow canter, already two or more leagues from the Gadra encampment. The herds had swung round to the southeast the night before, so he had seen no one on his journey out. When he first caught sight of the Bargast dogs, he thought they might be wolves, but upon seeing Torrent they altered their route straight towards him, something no pack of wolves would do, and as they drew closer he could see their short-haired mottled hides, their shortened muzzles and small ears. Larger than any All or Lethary breed, the beasts were singularly savage. Until this moment they had ignored Torrent, beyond the occasional baring of fangs as they trotted past in the camp. He slipped his lance from its sling and anchored it in the stirrup step just inside his right foot. Six dogs, loping closer. They were, he realized, exhausted. Torrent reined in to await them, curious. The beasts slowed and then encircled the warrior and his horse. He watched as they sank down onto their bellies, jaws hanging, tongues lolling and slick with thick threads of saliva. Confused, Torrent settled back in the saddle. Could he just ride through this strange circle, continue on his way? If these were all dogs, what would their behavior signify? He shook his head. Maybe if they were drays, then he would imagine that an enemy had drawn near. Frowning, Torrent stood in his stirrups and squinted to the north, whence the dogs had come. Nothing. And then he shaded his eyes. Yes, nothing on the horizon, but above that horizon, circling birds? Possibly. What to do? Return to the camp, find a warrior and tell him or her of what he had seen? Your dogs found me. They laid themselves down, far to the north. Some birds. Torrent snorted. He gathered the reins and nudged his mount between two of the prone dogs, and then swung his horse northward. Birds were not worth reporting. He needed to see what had drawn them. Of the six dogs he left behind him, two fell into his wake, trotting. The remaining four rose and set out for the camp to the south. In the time of Red Mask, Torrent had known something close to contentment. The All had found someone to follow, a true leader, a savior. And when the great victories had come, the death of hundreds of Lethary invaders in fierce, triumphant battles, they were proof of Red Mask's destiny. He could not be certain when things began to go wrong, but he recalled the look in Toc Annister's eye, the cynical set of his foreign face, and with every comment the man uttered, the solid foundations of Torrent's faith seemed to reverberate as if struck deadly blows, until the first cracks arrived, until Torrent's very zeal was turned upon itself, jaded and mocking, and what had been a strength became a weakness. Such was the power of scepticism, a handful of words to dismantle certainty, like seeds flung at a stone wall. Tender greens and tiny roots, yes, but in time they would take down that wall. Contentment alone should have made Torrent suspicious. but it had reared up before him like a god of purity, and willingly he had knelt, head bowed, to take comfort in its shadow. In any other age, Red Mask could not have succeeded in commanding the All. Without the desperation, without the succession of defeats and mounting losses, without extinction itself looming before them like a cliff's edge, the tribes would have driven him away, as they had done once before. Yes, they had been wiser then. Some forces could not be defeated, and so it was with the Lethari. Their hunger for land, their need to possess and rule over all that they possessed, these were terrible desires that spread like the plague, poisoning the souls of the enemy. Once the fever of seeing the world as they did erupted like fire in one's brain, the war was over, the defeat absolute and irreversible. Even these Barghast, his barbaric saviors, were doomed. Akrinai traders set up camps up against the picket lines. Drasilhani horse sellers drove herd after herd in a mostly futile parade past the encampment, and every now and then a Barghast warrior would select one of the larger animals, examine it for a time, and then, with a dismissive bark of laughter, send it back to the herd. Before too long, Torrent believed, a breed of sufficient height and girth would arrive, and that would be that. Invaders did not stay invaders forever. Eventually, they became no different from every other tribe or people in a land. Languages muddied, blended, surrendered. Habits were exchanged like currency, and before too long, everyone saw the world the same way as everyone else. And if that way was wrong, then misery was assured for virtually everyone, for virtually ever. The All should have bowed to the Lethari. They would be alive now instead of lying in jumbled heaps of mouldering bones in the mud of a dead sea. Red Mask had sought to stop time itself. Of course, he failed. Sometimes belief was suicide. Torrent had cast away his faiths, his certainties, his precious beliefs. He did nothing to resist the young ones losing their language. He saw the ochre paint on their faces, the spiked hair, and was indifferent to it. Yes, he was the leader of the All, the last there would ever be, and it was his task to oversee the peaceful obliteration of his culture. Ways will pass. He vowed he would not miss them. No, Torrent wore no copper mask, not any more, and his face was clear as his eyes. He slowed his horse's canter as soon as he made out the corpses, the bodies scattered about. Crows and gold-beaked vultures moved here and there in the carrion dance, whilst Rinnazan flapped about, disturbing cape moths into flight, sudden blossoms of white petals that settled almost as quickly as they appeared, a scene of the plains that Torrent knew well. A troop of Barghast had been ambushed, slaughtered. He rode closer. No obvious tracks, neither foot nor hoof, led away from the killing ground. He saw how the Barghast had been in close formation, and that was odd, contrary to what Torrent had seen of their patrols. Perhaps, he thought, they had contracted defensively, which suggested an enemy in overwhelming numbers. But then, there was no sign of that, and whoever had murdered these warriors must have taken their own dead with them. He walked his horse in a circuit round the bodies, saw no trailing smears of blood, no swaths through the grasses to mark dragged heels. The bodies, he realized then, had not been looted. Their beautiful weapons were scattered about, the blades devoid of blood. Torrent felt his nerves awaken, as if brushed by something unholy. He looked once more at the corpses, not a contraction, but a converging, upon a single foe. And the wounds, despite the efforts of the scavengers, displayed nothing of what one would expect. As if they closed upon a beast. And see how the blows struck downward upon them. The plains bare? No, there are none left. The last surviving skin of one of those beasts, among my people, was said to be 7 generations old. He remembered the thing. Vast, yes, but tattered, and the claws had been removed and since lost. Still. Torrent glanced at the 2 dogs as they trotted up. The beasts looked preternaturally cowed, stubby tails ducked, the glances they sent him beseeching and frightened. If they had been all drays, they would now be moving on to the enemy's trail, eager, hackles raised. He scowled down at the quivering beasts. He swung his horse back round and set off for the Gadra camp. The dogs hurried after him. A beast, yet one that left no trail whatsoever. A ghost creature. Perhaps his solitary rides had come to an end. He would have to surrender to those eager women. They could take away his unease, he hoped. Leave the hunt to the Bargast. Give their shamans something worthwhile to do, instead of getting drunk on Duras beer every night. Report to the chief, and then be done with it. He already regretted riding out to find the bodies. For all he knew, the ghost creature was close, had in fact been watching him. Or something of its foul sorcery lingered upon the scene, and now he was marked, and it would find him no matter where he went. He could almost smell that sorcery clinging to his clothes, acrid, bitter as a snake's belly. Setok, who had once been named Styandi, and who in her dreams was witness to strange scenes of familiar faces speaking in strange tongues, of laughter and love and tenderness, an age in the time before her beasthood, stood facing the empty north. She had seen the four dogs come into the camp, in itself an event unworthy of much attention, and if the patrol was late in returning, well, perhaps they had surprised a mule deer and made a kill, thus explaining the absence of two dogs from the pack, as the beasts would have been strapped to a travois to carry back the meat. Explanations such as these served for the moment, despite the obvious flaws in logic. These four would have remained with the patrol in such a case, feeding on the butchered carcass and its offal and whatnot. Although the truth of it was, Setok spared few thoughts for what interpretations the nearby Bargast might kick up in small swirls of agitated dust, as they tracked with their eyes the sweat-lathered beasts, or for their growing alarm when the dogs then sank down onto their bellies. So she watched as a dozen or so warriors gathered weapons and slowly converged on the exhausted beasts, and then returned her attention to the north. Yes, the animals stank of death. And the wild wolves in the emptiness beyond, who had given her life, had howled with the dawn their tale of terror. Yes, her first family ever remained close by, accorded a kind of holy protection in the legend that was the girl's finding. No Bargast would hunt the animals, and now even the Akrinai had been told the story of her birth among the pack, of the lone warrior's discovery of her. Spirit blessed, they now all said, when looking upon her, the holder of a thousand hearts. At first, that last title had confused Setok, but her memories slowly awakened with each day that she grew older, taller, sharper-eyed. Yes, she held within herself a thousand hearts, even more. Wolf gifts, milk she had suckled, milk of blood, milk of a thousand slain brothers and sisters. And did she not recall a night of terror and slaughter? A knight fleeing in the darkness? They spoke of her legend, and even the shoulder seers made her offerings and would come up and touch her to ease their troubled expressions. And now the great warlock, the finder of the Bargast gods, the one named Kafal, had come to the Gadra to speak with her, to search her soul, if she so permitted it. The wild wolves cried out to her, their minds a confused tumult of fear and worry. Anxious for their child, yes, and for a future time when storms gathered from every horizon. They understood that she would be at the very heart of that celestial conflagration. They begged to sacrifice their own lives so that she might live, and that she would not permit. If she was spirit-blessed, then the wolves were the spirits that had so blessed her. If she was a thing to be worshipped here among the Bargast, then she was but a symbol of the wild, and it was this wild that must be worshipped, if only they could see that. She glanced back at the cowering dogs, and felt a rush of sorrowful regret at what such beasts could have been, if their wildness was not so chained, so bound and muzzled.
God, my children, does not await us in the wilderness. God, my children, is the wilderness. Witness its laws and be humbled. In humility, find peace. But know this, peace is not always life. Sometimes peace is death. In the face of this, how can one not be humble?
The wild laws are the only laws.
She would give these words to Cathal. She would see in his face their effect. And then she would tell him that the Gadra clan was going to die, and that many other Barghast clans would follow. She would warn him to look to the skies, for from the skies death was coming. She would warn him against further journeys. He must return to his own clan. He must make peace with the spirit of his own kin, a peace of life before the arrival of the peace of death. Warriors had gathered round the dogs, readying weapons and such. Tension flowed out from them in ripples, spreading through the camp. In moments, a war leader would be selected from among the score or so milling about. Setoc pitied them all, but especially that doomed leader. A wind was blowing in from the east, scratching loose her long sun-bleached hair until it whispered across her face like withered grass. And still the stench of death filled her senses. Cathal's heavy features had broadened, grown more robust since his youth, and there were deeply etched lines of stress between his brows and framing his mouth. Years ago, in a pit beneath a temple floor, he had spoken with the One Who Blesses, with the Malazan captain, Ganos Paran, and seeking to impress the man, seeking to prove that somehow his wisdom belied his few years, he had uttered words he had heard his father use, claiming them as his own.
A man possessing power must act decisively, else it trickle away through his fingers.
The observation, while undoubtedly true, now echoed sourly. The voice that made that pronouncement, back then, was all wrong. It had no right to the words. Cathal could not believe his own pretensions uttered by that younger self, that bold, clear-eyed fool. A pointless, stupid accident had stolen away his father, Humbral Tar. For all that the huge, wise warrior had wielded his power, neither wisdom nor that power availed him against blind chance. The lesson was plain, the message bleak and humbling. Power was proof against nothing, and that was the only wisdom worth recognizing. He wondered what had happened to that miserable Malazan captain, chosen and cursed. And was there any real difference between the two? And he wondered, too, why he now longed to speak with Ganos Paran, to exchange a new set of words, these ones more honest, more measured, more knowing. Yes, the young were quick with judgment, quick to chastise their torpid elders. The young understood nothing about the value of sober contemplation. Ganos Paran had been indecisive in Cathal's eyes back then. Pitifully, frustratingly so. But to the Cathal of this day, here on this foreign plain under foreign skies, that Malazan of years ago had been rightly cautious, measured by a wisdom to which young Cathal had been woefully blind.
And this is how we gauge a life. This is how we build the bridge from what we were to what we are. Ganos Paran, do you ever look down? Do you ever stand frozen in place by that depthless chasm below? Do you ever dream of jumping?
Onos Tulan had been given all the power Cathal's own father had once commanded, and there was nothing undeserved in that. And now, slowly, inexorably, it was trickling away through the fingers of that ancient warrior. Cathal could do nothing to stop it. He was as helpless as Tul himself. Once again, blind chance had conspired against the Barghast. When word reached him that war dogs had returned to the camp, beasts bereft of escort and therefore mutely announcing that something ill had befallen the scouting troop, and that a war party was forming to set out on the back trail, Cathal drew on his Bedouin hide cloak, grunting beneath its weight, and kicked at the ragged, tufted doll crumpled on the tent floor near the foot of his cot.
"Wake up!"
The stick snare spat and snarled as it scrambled upright.
"Very funny. Respect your elders, O great warlock."
The irony oozing like pine sap from the title made Cathal wince. And then he cursed himself when Talamander snorted in amusement upon seeing the effect of his mockery. He paused at the entrance.
"We should have burned you on a pyre long ago, stick snare. Too many value me to let you do that. I travel the warrens. I deliver messages and treat with foreign gods.
We speak of matters of vast importance. War, betrayals, alliances, betrayals. You're repeating yourself. And war. And are the Bargast gods pleased with your efforts, Talamandas? Or do they snarl with fury as you flit this way and that at the behest of human gods? They cannot live in isolation. We cannot. They are stubborn. They lack all sophistication. They embarrass me.
Sighing, Cafal stepped outside. The stick snare scrambled after him, skittish as a stoat.
If we fight alone, we will all die. We need allies.
Cafal paused and looked down, wondering if Talamandas was perhaps insane. How many times could they repeat this same conversation?
Allies against whom?
He asked, as he had done countless times before.
Against what comes?
And there, the same meaningless answer, the kind of answer neither Cafal nor Tool could use. Hissing under his breath, the great warlock set off once more, ignoring Talamandas, who scrambled in his wake. The war party had left the camp. At a trot, the warriors were already reaching the north ridge. Once over the crest, they would vanish from sight. Cafal saw the wolf child Setok standing at the camp's edge, evidently watching the warriors, and something in her stance suggested she longed to lope after them, teeth bared and hackles raised, eager to join in the hunt. He set out in that direction. There was no doubt that she was Lethary, but that legacy existed only on the surface. Her skin, her features, the traits of whatever parents had given her birth and then lost her. But that nascent impression of civilization had since faded, eroded away. She had been given back to the wild, a virgin sacrifice whose soul had been devoured whole. She belonged to the wolves, and perhaps to the wolf god and goddess, the lord and lady of the beast throne. The Bargast had come to find the grey swords, to fight at their side, believing that Tok Annister and his army knew the enemy awaiting them. The Bargast gods had been eager to serve Tog and Fandere, to run with the bold pack in search of blood and glory. They had been, Cafal now understood, worse than children. The grey swords were little more than rotting meat when the first scouts found them. So much for glory. Was Setok the inheritor of the blessing once bestowed upon the grey swords? Was she now the child of Tog and Fandere? Even Talamandas did not know.
Not her!
The stick snare now snarled behind him.
Cast her out, Cafal! Banish her to the wastes where she belongs!
But he continued on. When he was a dozen paces away, she briefly glanced back at him before returning her attention upon the empty lands to the north. Moments later, he reached her side.
They are going to die, she said.
What? Who?
The warriors who just left. They will die as did the scout troop. You have found the enemy, great warlock. But it is the wrong enemy. Again.
Cafal swung round. He saw Talamandas squatting in the grasses 5 paces back.
Chase them down, he told the stick snare. Bring them back. Believe nothing she says. This is not a request, Talamandas.
With a mocking cackle, the stick snare darted past, bounding like a bee-stung hare onto the trail of the war party.
There is no use in doing that, Setok said. This entire clan is doomed.
Such pronouncements weary me,
Cafal replied.
You are like a poison thorn in this clan's heart, stealing its strength, its pride.
Is that why you've come, she asked, to pluck out this thorn?
If I must.
Then why are you waiting?
I would know the source of your pronouncements, Setok. Are you plagued with visions? Do spirits visit your dreams? What have you seen? What do you know?
The Rinnazan whisper in my ear, she said.
Was she taunting him?
Winged lizards do not whisper anything, Setok.
No.
No. Is nonsense all you can give me? Am I to be nothing but the object of your contempt?
The All-Warrior, the one so aptly named Torrent, has found the war party. He adds to your doll's exhortations, but the war leader is young, fearless. Why do the fools choose one such as that?
When older warriors see a pack of war dogs drag themselves into the camp, said Cathal, they hold a meeting to discuss matters. The young ones clutch their weapons and leap to their feet, eyes blazing.
It is a wonder, she observed, that any warrior ever manages to get old.
Yes, it is.
The All has convinced them.
Not Telemandus?
No. They say dead warlocks never have anything good to say. They say your stick snare kneels at the foot of the Death Reaper. They call it a Malazan puppet.
By the spirits, I cannot argue against any of that. You sense all that takes place on these plains, Setok. What do you know of the enemy that killed the scouts?
Only what the Rinnazan whisper, great warlock.
Winged lizards again, spirits below. In our homeland, on the high desert mesas, there are smaller versions that are called Rizan.
Smaller, yes.
He frowned.
Meaning?
She shrugged.
Just that, smaller.
He wanted to shake her, rattle loose her secrets.
Who killed our scouts?
She bared her teeth but did not face him.
I have already told you, great warlock. Tell me, have you seen the green spears in the sky at night?
Of course.
What are they?
I don't know. Things have been known to fall from the sky, whilst others simply pass by like wagons set ablaze, crossing the firmament night after night for weeks or months, and then vanishing as mysteriously as they arrived.
Uncaring of the world below.
Yes. The firmament is speckled with countless worlds no different from ours. To the stars and to the great burning wagons, we are as motes of dust.
She turned to study him as he spoke these words.
That is interesting. This is what the Barghast believe?
What do the wolves believe, Setok?
Tell me, she said, when a hunter throws a javelin at a fleeing antelope, does the hunter aim at the beast?
Yes and no. To strike true, the hunter must throw into the space in front of the antelope, into the path it will take.
He studied her.
Are you saying that these spears of green fire are the javelins of a hunter, and that we are the antelope?
And if the antelope darts this way, dodges that?
A good hunter will not miss.
The war party had reappeared on the ridge, and accompanying it was the all-warrior on his horse, along with two more dogs. Cathal said,
I will find Stallman now. He will want to speak with you, Setok.
He hesitated, and then added,
Perhaps the Gadra war chief can glean clearer answers from you, for in that I have surely failed.
The wolves are clear enough, she replied, when speaking of war. All else confuses them.
So you indeed serve the lady and lord of the beast throne, as would a priestess.
She shrugged.
Who,
Cathal asked again,
is the enemy?
Setok looked at him.
The enemy, great warlock, is peace.
And she smiled. The ribbers had dragged Visto's body a dozen or so paces out into the flat, until something warned them against eating the wrinkled, leathery flesh of the dead boy. With the dawn, Badal and a few others walked out to stand round the shrunken, stomach-burst thing that had once been Visto. The others waited for Badal to find her words. Rut was late in arriving, as he had to check on Held and make adjustments to the baby's wrap. By the time he joined them, Badal was ready.
Hear me, then, she said, at Visto's deading.
She blew flies from her lips and then scanned the faces arrayed round her. There was an expression she wanted to find, but couldn't. Even remembering what it looked like was hard, no, impossible. She'd lost it, truth be told, but wanted it, and she knew she would recognize it as soon as she saw it again. An expression, some kind of expression. What was it? After a moment, she spoke.
We all come from some place, and Visto was no different. He come from some place, and it was different, and it was the same, no, different, if you know what I mean. And you do. You have to. All you standing here. The point is that Visto, he couldn't remember anything about that place, except that he come from it. And that's like lots of you. So let's say now he's gone back there, to that place, where he come from. And everything he sees, he remembers. And everything he remembers is new.
They always waited, never knowing if she was finished, until it became obvious that she was. And in that time Badal looked down at Visto. The eggs of the Satra riders clung like crumbs to Visto's lips, as if he had been gobbling down cake. The adult riders had chewed out through his stomach, and no one knew where they went, maybe into the ground. They did all that at night. Maybe some of the ribbers had been careless, with their eager jaws and all, which was good, since then there'd be fewer of them strong enough to launch attacks on the ribby snake. It wasn't as bad having them totter along in the distance, keeping pace, getting weaker, just as the children did, until they lay down and weren't trouble anymore. You could live with that, no different from the crows and vultures overhead. Animals showed, didn't they, how to believe in patience. She lifted her head, and as if that was a signal, the others turned away and walked slowly back to the trail, where the ones who could were standing, getting ready for the day's march. Rut said,
I liked Visto. We all liked Visto.
We shouldn't have.
No.
Because that makes it harder.
The Satra riders liked Visto, too, even more than we did.
Rut shifted Held from the crook of his right arm into the crook of his left arm.
I'm mad at Visto now.
Braderal, who had showed up to walk at the snake's head only 2 days ago, maybe coming from back down the snake's body, maybe coming from somewhere else, walked out to stand close to them, as if she wanted to be part of something. Something made up of Rut and Held and Badal. But whatever that something was, it had no room for Braderal. Visto's deading didn't leave a hole. The space just closed up. Besides, something about the tall, bony girl made Badal uneasy. Her face was too white beneath all this sun. She reminded Badal of the bone skins. What were they called again? Quisitors? Quitters? Could be, yes, the quitters. The bone skins who stood taller than anyone else, and from that height they saw everything and commanded everyone, and when they said, starve and die, why, that's just what everyone did. If they knew about the Chal Managal, they would be angry. They might even chase after it and find the head, find Rut and Badal, and then do that quitting thing with the hands, the thing that broke the necks of people like Rut and Badal.
We would be quitted unto deading.
Badal?
She looked at Rut, blew flies from her lips, and then, ignoring Braderal as if she wasn't there, set off to rejoin the ribby snake. The track stretched westward, straight like an insult to nature, and at the distant end of the stony, lifeless ground, the horizon glittered as if crusted with crushed glass. She heard Rut's scrabbling steps coming up behind her, and then veering slightly as he made for the front of the column. She might be his second, but Badal wouldn't walk with him. Rut had Held. That was enough for Rut. Badal had her words, and that was almost too much. She saw Braderal follow Rut. They were almost the same height, but Rut looked the weaker, closer to deading than Braderal. And seeing that, Badal felt a flash of anger. It should have been the other way round. They needed Rut. They didn't need Braderal. Unless she was planning on stepping into Rut's place when Rut finally broke, planning on being the snake's new head, its slithery tongue, its scaly jaws. Yes, that might be what Badal was seeing. And Braderal would take up Held all wrapped tight and safe from the sun, and they'd all set out on another day, with her instead of Rut leading them. That made a kind of sense. no different than with the river packs. When the leader got sick or lame or just wasn't strong enough anymore, why, that other river that showed up and started trotting alongside it, it was there just for this moment, to take over, to keep things going. No different from what sons did to fathers and daughters did to mothers, and princes to kings and princesses to queens. Braderal walked almost at Rut's side, up there at the head. Maybe she talked with Rut, maybe she didn't. Some things didn't need talking about, and besides, Rut wasn't one to say much anyway.
"I don't like Braderal."
If anyone nearby heard her, they gave no sign. Badal blew to scatter the flies. They needed to find water. Even half a day without it, and the snake would get too ribby, especially in this heat. On this morning, she did as she always did, eating her fill of words, drinking deep the spaces in between, and mad, so mad that none of it gave her any strength. Sadik had been Rut's second follower, the first being Held. He now walked among the four or so, moving in a loose clump a few paces behind Rut and the new girl. Badal was a little way back, in the next clump. Sadik worshipped her, but he would not draw close to her, not yet, because there would be no point. He had few words of his own. He'd lost most of them early on in this journey. So long as he was in hearing range of Badal, he was content. She fed him. With her sayings and her seeings, she kept Sadik alive. He thought about what she had said for Visto's deading, about how some of it wasn't true, the bit about Visto not remembering anything about where he'd come from. He'd remembered too much, in fact, so Badal had knowingly told an untruth about Visto. At his deading, why had she done that?
"Because Visto was gone. Her words weren't for him because he was gone. They were for us. She was telling us to give up remembering. Give it up so when we find it again it all feels new. Not the remembering itself, but the things we remembered. The cities and villages and the families and the laughing. The water and the food and full stomachs. Is that what she was telling us?"
Well, he had his meal for the day, didn't he? She was generous that way. The feet at the ends of his legs were like wads of leather. They didn't feel much, and that was a relief, since the stones on the track were sharp, and so many others had bleeding feet, making it hard to walk. The ground was even worse to either side of the trail. Badal was smart. She was the brain behind the jaws, the tongue. She took what the snake's eyes saw. She made sense of what the tongue tasted. She gave names to the things of this new world, the moths that pretended to be leaves and the trees that invited the moths to be leaves, so that five trees shared one set of leaves between them, and when the trees got hungry, off went the leaves, looking for food. No other tree could do that, and so no other tree lived on the Elan. She talked about the Javal, the carrion birds no bigger than sparrows, that were the first to swarm a body when it fell, using their sharp beaks to stab and drink. Sometimes the Javal didn't even wait for the body to fall. Sadik had seen them attacking a wounded river, even vultures and crows, sometimes each other too, when the frenzy was on them. Satra riders, as what did in poor Visto, and flowworms that moved in a seething carpet, pushing beneath a corpse to squirm in the shade. They bit and drenched themselves in whatever seeped down, and as the ground softened, down they went, finally able to pierce the skin of the blistered earth. Sadik looked in wonder at this new world, listened in awe as Badal gave the strange things names and made for them all a new language. Close to noon they found a waterhole. The crumbled foundations of makeshift corrals surrounded the shallow, muddy pit. The snake halted, and then began a slow, tortured crawl into and out of the churned-up mud. The weight alone killed scores, and even as children emerged from the morass, slathered black, some fell to convulsions, curling round mud-filled guts. Some spilled out their bowels, fouling things for everyone that came after. It was another bad day for the Chal Managal. Later in the afternoon, during the worst of the heat, they spied a greyish cloud on the horizon ahead. The rivers began howling, dancing in terror, and as the cloud rushed closer, the dogs finally fled. What looked like rain wasn't rain. What looked like a cloud wasn't a cloud. These were locusts, but not the normal kind of locusts. Wings glittering, the swarm filling half the sky, and then all the sky, the sound a clicking roar, the rasp of wings, the snapping open of jaws, each creature a finger long. Out from within the cloud, as it engulfed the column, lunged buzzing knots where the insects massed almost solid. When one of these hammered into a huddle of children, shrieks of pain and horror erupted, the flash of red meat and then bone. And then the horde swept on, leaving behind clumps of hair and heaps of gleaming bone. These locusts ate meat. This was the first day of the shards.